Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome back to Food Integrity Now for the second part of our Growing Your Own Food with Evan Fold series. Today, I'm here with my co-host, Carol Gervais. Welcome, Carol.
Good to be here, Matt.
All right. And also we have Evan Folds. Evan, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Evan Folds, for those of you who missed the show last week, is the founder of Progress Earth. And for the full introduction, you can go back and listen to our show in the archives. So this is this show. In this Growing Your Own Food series, we had a little introduction last week, and Evan talked about biodynamics and some of the different principles that he's learned and has gotten into in his extensive history in indoor and outdoor gardening. And this week, he's coming to talk to us about planting your own backyard garden. This is a place we're going to start. Probably most people have a little space in their backyard where they can start a little garden. And you know, Evan's going to talk to us about site location and a few of the different foundational elements that we need to know to have a successful and fruitful garden. So, Evan, let's go ahead and get started. What are some of the things that someone needs to consider when choosing a site for a garden, and what do they need to prepare?
Yeah, well, basically, the first part is generally just a common sense approach. You know, do you have shading from trees that's going to be disruptive? You know, normally you can, if you give yourself a day or two during the growing season and just kind of walk outside and give yourself an idea of you know, where the sun gets blocked during the day, and you want to look for at least, you know, I'd say at the minimum to get any kind of production, at least 6 hours of direct light. If you have less than that, you're going to start waning on the production. I mean, I can kind of give you an example from my backyard. I think I mentioned last week I've got pine trees, and they're just kind of swamping me. And the kind of pine trees you can't even really wrap your arms around. They're huge old growth trees. And, you know, while they don't create the densest of canopy, they do disrupt the light pretty good. Now, I've got a raised bed in the back portion of my yard that gets about six hours of light, if I had to guess. And the result is, you know, I've got a pepper garden in this raised bed. And the peppers, you know, they don't grow anywhere near as fast as the area of my yard that gets full sun, but they do produce fruit. So, you know, I would call it a worthwhile endeavor to do that. But, you know, something like a tomato plant that's really going to be a really heavy feeder, you know, might not do as well in that location. So, you know, if you're kind of on the fence with light, you know, one of the things you can do is obviously look to get the trees taken out. You know, as much as we love trees, there's also a benefit to being able to produce your food. So, you know, I'd suggest calling around some tree companies and taking a look at what it might cost. You might be surprised, you know, especially in this economy. There's a lot of people out there that would do that for a pretty reasonable price. So, you know, once you've gotten kind of a good feel of, you know, your light situation, the next step is really taking inventory of really what kind of soil you have in your area. You know, where you guys are over in Colorado, I've heard that there's a lot more clay in the soil. Say for, you know, where we are on the coast in North Carolina, we have a really sandy soil. So, you know, different soils can be dealt with in different ways. But you also, the good thing is when you're taking a natural approach towards what you're doing, it also is a lot simpler than it can be made when you're taking an artificial approach. So, you know, I'd highly suggest a soil test. The extension services in most states will do that for free, although they don't look for everything necessary to really take a gauge, a full gauge of you know, soil balance. And I think we'll probably get into that in a minute. And so, you know, look at your light, take an inventory of your soil, get an idea of you know, whether it grows good plants or not. You probably got some other plants in your landscape that you're used to dealing with. And, you know, you kind of look at them to reconcile that. And then basically from there, you know, once you've got a feel for it, you know, honestly, the hardest part in all of this and starting a garden is just doing it for the first time. So, you know, even if, you know, in other words, don't be scared to screw it up the first time. You know, I mean, one way to take an inventory of your soil is to, you know, get a tomato start or a pepper start from the garden center and just dig you a hole and start watering it and see what happens. You know, because most of the knowledge in these kinds of situations is born of experience, not necessarily something that you'll read in a book or, you know, even listening to a radio show.
Hey, getting into it, I've been building my own greenhouse right now, and given that it is a solstice today, happy solstice, everyone.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, cool.
I am getting a little bit. I'm a little bit late in getting started. I'm probably just going to be able to plant some plants that I got from my farmer friend probably tomorrow or the day after. But I had to level an area of my ground and dig into a mountain. And it was pretty tough work. And I realized as I was digging that I was getting down to some really sandy, rocky stuff. And I lost a lot of topsoil that I wasn't keeping track of where of the different levels, and I realized as I was getting down into it that I had this huge pile of dirt and all the good topsoil was on the bottom and I had all the sandy stuff that was on the top. So I guess
right.
that's one of the things that as you get experience you learn more about that, and I really wouldn't have known about that unless I did it myself.
Yeah, you know, that's. I'm glad you framed it in that way, because that's, you know, we work with a lot of farmers, and we have a really intense, maybe 6-7 page Word document that we request new clients to fill out and complete, and some of it is involved in, you know, digging, you know, 4 feet down in your soil to investigate it, and very few farmers have ever done that, you know, but it does tell you a lot. You know, if you don't know what you're working with, it's hard to really gauge an expectation. But that's absolutely correct. And it also illustrates another point that really any landscape, I mean, I assume you may be in more of a virgin situation. You know, I don't know if it's a developed piece of property you're developing your greenhouse on, but, you know, any kind of neighborhood type home has been developed at some point, you know, and even if it was 50 years ago, you've either clear cut a forest and put sod down on it most of the times, or you brought in 2 feet of topsoil to, you know, level the land, or you removed 2 feet of topsoil or some element of the topsoil. So in any of those variables, obviously a forest soil is completely different from what you'd want to grow a vegetable garden in. And we can speak specifically about the differences in a minute. Basically, that, you know, a forest is fungal dominant, is a mature soil, whereas, you know, what you're going to want a vegetable garden in is more of a immature soil. It's more of a bacterial dominant type soil. But, you know, even if you're bringing in cheap, if you wanted to ask a question on that, go ahead.
Yeah, well, tell us about, let's go into a little bit about that, those two different types of soils that you just mentioned.
Sure. Well, generally, the way to think about it is nature has a certain direction and impulse, and it's building complexity primarily biologically over time. And what microbes you have present determines somewhat of the mineral constitution that you have, for lack of a better word. So, to think about it, you know, say you raise an acre of land and you just let it go fallow and let it regrow naturally. Well, the first things that start to grow are the annual plants. You know, think weeds, for example. Then you get more of the perennials, you know, those things like a turf, for example, or vegetables or things of that nature. Then you go, get shrubs, then you get trees, and then you get mature trees. So that movement there is called succession. And nature really can't be stopped in that regard. And honestly, the reason that people have weeds in their turf is because the soil is imbalanced. And the weed's role is to balance the soil in order to allow the perennial turf to take it over. So the mindset that, you know, the weeds are coming into from my neighbor's yard and these kinds of things are really just thought forms. They're not really born of any significance, really. And the fact that you're going in there and trying to kill all the weeds with herbicides, or the majority of people do, is really creating more problems than it is helping, because it's stressing the perennial turf. So to kind of bring that home, you can use the idea of a dandelion, for example. You know, everybody's familiar. It's kind of the quintessential weed. It's kind of, you know, it's what's in those Roundup commercials where they got the Wild West music going and the guys are killing the weeds in their driveway and that kind of thing. Marketing of that is pretty crazy if you really square it. But, you know, we use dandelions as medicinal herbs. You know, my mother drinks a dandelion tea almost every day. And the reason she does that is because it's really for the calcium content, and it's got other micronutrients. But the idea being the role of the dandelion in nature is to regenerate calcium. So if you've ever pulled a dandelion up from the ground, its taproot goes way down into the subsoil. And it's what it's doing is it's bringing calcium back up to the topsoil and fixing it from the air. And then every year the annual weed dies to deliver the minerals that it fixes to the topsoil. So it's really the method that soil uses to create balance in itself, a weed is. We've, of course, judged it into an enemy and go to any extent to kill it. But in reality, it's helping us. Now, the idea here is not to wait on the weeds because it could take 50 to 100 years maybe for it to actually happen. But the idea is if you take a soil test and actually reconcile what your deficiencies are based on what weeds are growing, it gets really, really interesting. And what we've gotten to a point where we can do that with our lawn care company. We can take a new client, look at our weed scratch spectrum in the lawn, and actually tell you what your deficiencies are before we take the soil test. It's that direct. So what's really interesting in Wilmington where we are, most, I'd say maybe 90% of the soil tests we take have too much calcium to begin with. And we can talk about detail of how you know, figure that out from the soil test in a minute. But the idea being we've already got too much calcium. So, and you know, everybody out there's blown a dandelion seed before. You can't prevent that from going where it wants. It's you know, we don't live in bubbles to an extent. So, you know, this idea that weed seeds are contaminating your lawn is another misnomer. Weed seeds stay dormant for up to 50 years in the soil. It's really about the impulse and the need for that weed to grow that stimulates it to germinate and grow. So, in the end, in Wilmington, we don't have dandelions growing hardly anywhere. And this is kind of what I use to make a connection with people in our town, because a lot of people are from other areas. We have a lot of people that move into town, and I'm from Greensboro, about 3 hours up the road in the middle of the state. It's really heavy clay soils, really low calcium on soil tests. We got dandelions everywhere. So, you know, that's kind of an interesting way to look at weeds and really a way into thinking about balance in soil and the relevance of it relative to success in vegetable gardening.
That's so cool.
Wow, that's...
Go ahead, Carol.
Yeah, I just have never thought of weeds in that way before. That's very interesting.
Yeah.
I have a quick question about what you were talking about, the calcium. I heard that if you put eggshells in your soil, that helps put calcium into the soil, and it's really good for the soil. Is that a wives tale, or is that true? Do you know anything about that?
No, it's absolutely true. You know, it's not immediately available. You're going to get it's more of a slow release type calcium. Oyster shells, another good source of that. You'll see that a lot of that in potting mixes and things of that nature. It's also used to buffer pH. But that's absolutely true. It's just, you know, it's never a direct. You know, take the idea of a blossom end rot. You know, most everybody that's grown tomatoes has experienced that at some point. And there's many products on the market that have big ripe tomatoes on it and are marketed as a calcium blossom end rot product. And the reason the blossom end rot occurs is because calcium can't reach the end of the fruit. But however, that doesn't mean it's a calcium deficiency a lot of the times. It could be, you know, if you don't sucker your tomato plants, which is kind of the new growth that comes out of the node, which is the branch of the tomato versus the primary growth tip, and then you'll get growth out of that node. If you've grown tomatoes, you know what I'm talking about. It's a really good practice to sucker it, meaning take that new growth out, because it essentially prevents the plant from concentrating on what it really wants, what you really want it to do, really, is produce fruit. But if you don't sucker it, it becomes so thick that you don't get really good air movement, and that can be a cause of blossom end rot. Another example of blossom end rot that's not a calcium direct is, in order for plants to use calcium in soil, boron has to be present. And when you're balancing soil, you want 1/1000th of the soil test to read boron. So if you've got, you know, 1,000 in terms of the metric of calcium in the soil, you'd want 0.1 boron in the soil. So what we find in Wilmington, we have tremendous boron deficiencies, too much calcium and tremendous boron deficiencies. And people get blossom end rot all the time. So you know, farming and gardening is not a black and white endeavor. It's never an easy, specific, direct answer a lot of the times. And that's one of the reasons why you want to take a more natural approach in doing these sorts of things, because it really can't be up to the human to figure out what the plant needs. And even more directly, it can't be up to the human to figure out what the soil needs. So it's a living, dynamic, really complicated thing that you can take a couple of different tacks on delivering everything needed to the soil and letting the life in the soil, primarily the microorganisms, really regulate that and figure it out for you.
So let's go into that soil testing. You mentioned that there's a place that where you could get it done for free. Where is that?
Yeah. Well, in North Carolina, the Extension Service, which is really born of the land grant universities, the creation of those back in the early 1900s. So, you know, they're what was set up by the government to advise farmers on how to produce food when kind of industrial agriculture was coming into its own. The unfortunate byproduct of the funding source of, and not to pick on the government, not that they're innocent, but most of the companies out there, you know, the Cargills and the Monsantos and the chemical companies that create all of the products that are mainstream America gardening products, were really, they're the ones that funded all of these university research. So the result of that is the last 50 years has been really our head in the sand looking at the mineral approach to farming. Very little research has been done biologically at all. So one of the positive byproducts of that is that the Extension Service does offer soil testing to the public for free. And I don't know if that's the case where you guys are, but it is in North Carolina. So, you know, just kind of finish the point on kind of the unfortunate situation. It's quite convoluted. You know, it might be a free soil test, but for example, they don't, and at least in North Carolina, and every state's different agriculturally, so I can just speak for North Carolina, they don't assay or test for the boron in the soil. So what they do is really give you a recommendation based on pH alone. And pH is really not the most important aspect of your soil. It's what most everybody pays attention to, but in the end, it's the afterthought. If you balance the minerals in your soil, the pH is always perfect. So, you know, I'd suggest people call an Extension Service just to get, you know, an initial reading. But unfortunately, in the end, in order to really give you everything that you need to get to the point of true mineral balance in the soil, you really need to seek out a private lab.
I see. And what would someone search for in their research with that?
What I would suggest is start with there's a man named Dr. William Albrecht, and he was pretty much the grandfather of soil science, and he did his research in Missouri back in 1940s, and he pretty much told everyone where the sweet spot in soil was minerally, you know, 60, 70, 80 years ago now. And that's really what we base, you know, as a natural approach and as Progress Earth, we have a soil test and prescription service where you can actually send us your soil sample. We'll deal with the lab for you and then actually deliver you a prescription, we call it, of what to add per 1,000 square feet. So instead of saying, you know, add lime and make your pH on a piece of paper correct, it's actually looking at every single element known to be needed by plants and then telling you, you know, 20 pounds of lime, 10 pounds of rock phosphate, 30 pounds of, you know, gypsum, and 2 pounds of borax. And so it actually dials it in for you. And then when you deliver that textured prescription to your soil, that's what brings your pH into balance. And, you know, I think, you know, that's something that we're not taught in school, so it's not surprising that people aren't aware of. But you know, a way to think about it is kind of going to a doctor and getting a pill instead of the doctor asking you to change your diet. That's really all the Extension Service is they're a doctor, an MD doctor, and they're prescribing pH medication. You know, that they're not giving you actually what you need in terms of really creating true health in the scenario.
Right. It's addressing the symptom and not the cause.
Precisely. That's exactly
so right. Do you have info for if people go to your website, Progress Earth, is info on there for having their soil tested by you?
It is, yeah. If you go to the products link and just look down on the left-hand side, there's a link called Soil Test and RX Prescription. And if you click on that, it'll kind of give you a spiel of why it's important to conduct an assay along those lines. And then at this point, we don't sell products on the website, so you you know, you can just call the 1-800 number on the site and get with Zach or Tom, and we could get you taken care of.
Great. Well, we're going to take a break, but before we do that, why don't you tell us your website again, for those who didn't hear the past show, and also give us the 800 number.
Yeah. Our website is progressearth.com, and our 800 number is 1-800-970-2864.
Great. Well, we're going to take a short break for a message from our sponsors. We'll be right back in a few minutes.
Are you experiencing anxiety, anger, depression, or low self-esteem? Do you beat yourself up or sabotage what you truly want to achieve? Hi, this is Jeannie Smith, and at Open Heart Healing, I combine counseling, Gestalt therapy, and Tai Chi energy work to assist those who truly desire to bring quality and joy back into their lives. My office is located on South Perry Street here in Castle Rock. Call me for a free consultation at 303-660-6373. Again, that's 303-660-6373, or visit me at openhearthealing.com.
Hi everyone, this is Carol again, and I just wanted to talk to you about one of our new sponsors, Hole in the Wall Herb and Vitamin Shop up in Woodland Park. The owners, Mark and Nancy Duvall, are not only close personal friends, but they're also my nutritional gurus. They are now selling, teaching, and doing Acira bioenergetic testing on their clients. I had this done, and I found out all my food allergies, emotional stressors, environmental sensitivities, hormonal balance, and I received a customized homeopathic remedy. Please call them for more information at 1-800-437-3240.
Welcome back to Food Integrity Now with our special guest, Evan Folds. This segment, talking about planting your own backyard garden. In the first part, we left for that break. Evan was discussing soil health and getting your soil tested. Evan, what do you think, for someone starting out, is it easier for them to go with a raised bed or to just try to grow in the soil that they have?
Well, the short answer is a raised bed. There's more upfront costs, and that's, you know, that depends on the situation. I mean, you can make a raised bed out of many different materials. It really depends on the state of the soil. You know, if you were pulling up a lawn, you know, my mom did that, and mentioned to live in Greensboro, really heavily clay soil, and she's really committed to removing all of the grass out of her landscape, which in the end is a pretty worthwhile endeavor considering what turf is in the end. It's something that we pay lots of money and pollute very heavily to, in an attempt to keep green and keep weeds out of it. So, you know, there's a book actually called Food Not Lawns that I'd recommend to people that have an interest in rectifying their turf into a garden. But, you know, there's a little bit more commitment in terms of building the health in the soil, but arguably in the end that you can get more out of it in terms of the area if you did have a virgin plot that wasn't in raised beds. Having said that, you know, we work with a product, a biodynamic compost we call BD Thunder, and it basically, we're about to rename the product and call it Soil Recharge. And the reason that we're doing that is over the years we've had, I can't tell you how many customers in raised bed situations that, you know, normally with a raised bed, you don't ever extract the soil out of it. So there's an idea you need to kind of, you know, sweeten it up over time. And what we found is that you can actually use the BD Thunder, what we're going to call Soil Recharge, as a way of literally recharging the soil. So, you know, this guy Ryan that works with me, he's been doing that for 3 years in a row in a raised bed with literally no fertilizer added. And it gets better every year. We have a raised bed in the parking lot in front of our retail store. We do that just for effect to show people that you don't really need, you know, a healthy farm or yard soil to get food produced. And we do the same thing. We add zero fertilizer. We, you know, we're adding compost teas every now and then, but the majority of it is this biodynamic compost. A little bit can go a really long way. You know, one of the other applications that it's used in is people that have indoor gardens that – one of the most depressing things about an indoor garden, if you're soil gardening or making your own mixes, is that you most people throw their potting soils and mixes away after they're done with it. And it's a tremendous waste. So what we normally recommend is to put all of that spent soil into a larger container, put some soil recharge in it, and then, you know, use it as a potting soil. So there's ways to get creative when you're using potting soils and different things that you can throw away in a value-added manner. But raised beds are a really good way to ensure success from the beginning. You know, it's one of the biggest frustrations in the world to put so much effort into, you know, maybe tilling up your land, preparing it, doing all the right things by the book, putting a plan in it, and you know, not having done a soil test and given it time to mature and not having success, you know, because it's really important. You know, I can speak to that from a retail perspective. It's really important that our customers have a good experience the first time that they try something they've never done before. I mean, that kind of makes sense. But containers and raised bed gardening is a really good way to go about doing that.
Hey, Evan, I have a question. In doing a raised bed garden, is there any kind of wood that's better than others? Like I have some boxes that I'm using to start some plants, and they're cedar.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a significance between different types of woods and which ones are better?
Yeah, you really want to stay away from untreated wood if your plants are exposed to it. You can always use liners and things like that, which would work. But cedar, in my opinion, is the best wood to use. That's what we build our raised beds out of. It's the most durable. You know, it'll last you 10 years.
But did you mean
maybe longer?
Did you mean stay away from treated wood, the green wood?
Yeah, treated wood. You know, like if you were going into a big box store and you've got the virgin wood that'll give you a splinter, and then you've got the treated wood that's really designed to be more manageable and not give you a splinter. But the types of chemicals that are used on the treated wood can actually leach into your soil, and that's something that there's pretty high level of documentation on. You know, if you did a web search on treated wood and raised beds, you'd probably get some pretty definitive feedback in regards to some of the dangers to doing that. But, you know, in the end, if you did have treated wood, you know, you could always line it with something. Or, you know, a lot of people use cinder blocks, you know, and I saw this really cool raised bed at a community garden the other day that was just cinder blocks in a rectangle, 4x8 rectangle. And then they actually had herbs planted in all the holes of the cinder blocks, you know. So there's any number of things that you can use for a raised bed if you look around. But I definitely, you know, the only concern I would put out there is just to make sure you're paying attention to not using chemically treated wood.
Cinder block, that's
why
a great idea.
It looked really cool too.
I was using cedar. I built my raised beds with some cedar 4x4s, and they smell great. And I understand that cedar is more more mold and pest resistant than other woods?
Yes, it is. It's actually cedar oil is used as a pesticide. I see that in ads all over the place, and there's a company in our town that advertises that. I haven't personally ever used it in that context, but yeah, that would be, you know, the odor and the potential help with deterring pests would be two definite benefits of cedar.
It was kind of expensive, though, so I really like that cinder block idea. I think you may use that for future raised beds that I build.
There you go.
What is a good depth for a raised bed? What do plants really need in terms of root space?
Well, if you haven't set it up properly, you'd be surprised how little depth is needed. You know, things like lettuce, some kind of herbs are deep rooted, but most herbs are shallow rooted. They tend to stay towards the surface and grow the roots laterally. So you really don't run into any issues almost with, you know, 4 inches of soil on something like that. I mean, you can grow lettuce in a seed flat. But something like a tomato that would need more depth, you know, it still probably wouldn't need any more than six eight inches of soil. We have a tomato that's mature, a cherry tomato plant that's mature and flowering in about 6 inches of soil in the raised bed that I discussed out in the parking lot. So, you know, it's one of those things where you can look at it and kind of say, well, how's that plant growing? You know, we grew a sunflower that, you know, the head of it was maybe twice the size of my head. I got a pretty big head, and it was maybe, you know, 8 feet high. It actually grew around the roof that we have it, this lip of the roof that we have it underneath, and it was all in 6 inches of soil. So a lot of it just depends on, you know, how you've got it set up, and especially if microbes are involved. If you're gardening biologically, the microbes help the plant do so many things that roots, you know, do for them. It's almost like an extension of the root without the plant having to grow it for itself, in a sense. So you can really get away with very little soil. Of course, having more depth than that wouldn't hurt at all. But really, I'd say at least 6 inches of soil, you know, if you're trying to plant something. I tend to, you know, when I'm building personally, I like to go a little bit deeper, say maybe 10 inches. But there's no reason to get, you know, 2 feet of soil in a raised bed, of course, unless you want to.
My farmer friend, I was asking what I should put in the raised bed. He recommended this organic mushroom compost, which I got a bunch of bags of that. But when I went to the store, there were so many different options. There was organic soil, there was manure, all sorts of different things. If people couldn't get that BT Thunder that you have, what are some good options that you recommend that people can find locally?
Yeah, well, you know, that's one of the things that, I mean, you're right, there are so many different options. One of the things about mushroom compost is that it's really nutritionally void. It doesn't have a lot of nutrition in it, primarily because fungi don't need minerals to grow. So a lot of what mushroom compost is the spent organic matter that mushrooms were grown in. So it's kind of a different animal than backyard compost, say, for example. It doesn't make it bad. It just means that you kind of have to – you need that in mind when you're setting your garden up. So what it is good for is creates good tilth in the soil. It retains moisture very well, and it's relatively inert, so you're not going to get any kind of pathogens really with it at all. One of the issues with – you know, you mentioned manure. You know, we used to call that product that we're going to – the Earth Recharge, that BD Thunder that I've been telling you about, we used to call that premium biodynamic compost. And one of the things that we ran into is that people were used to going to the hardware store and seeing Black Cow compost for $1 a gallon, and we were selling ours for like 30, 40 bucks. And people couldn't understand how, you know, oh, it's compost. Why are you selling it for that much? You know, we just – all of this pushback on it. And it's understandable, and it, so we since changed the name. But the reality is when you buy, like, the Black Cow compost and these kinds of manure-based composts at big box stores, it's really not plant food. It's not compost at all in the true sense of the word. I mean, when you put, you know, a banana peel in a compost pile and the microbes use their enzymes to break it down into plant food, that's what's called humus. Humus is the lowest decomposed state of organic matter. So I always like to say it, but like in a forest, the trees don't eat the leaves. They eat what the microbes make of it. So unless the microbes have made of it and created humus, plant food, out of what's being used, it's not available to the plant. So I say that just to make the reference to the manure. You know, manure is not plant food. It needs to be broken down biologically before it can be eaten by the plant. So a lot of what I've seen, I don't know if you guys have ever heard of lasagna gardening, but it's a really popular way of organizing a garden. And you basically make a 7-layered bean dip out of a different material like newspaper and raw material that has not been broken down into humus or plant food. And what happens is, especially if your soil is biologically dead, which the majority of people are in regards to the, you know, the development we spoke of at the beginning of the show, when you take the top 2 feet of soil off, that's all, like you said, that's all your topsoil. And that might have taken, you know, hundreds, thousands of years to create. So when you take all the biology away and you don't add any back deliberately, you know, microbes don't jump over the fence. You know, they're not like animals that we see. They move micrometers in their lifetime. So unless you've taken a conscious interest of introducing these microbes back into your soil, they're just not there. And so in the end, what happens is you're left with a situation that you know, can't break down. And when you plant a garden in raw materials, it's not going to work. But what I've seen many a time is people that have come into our retail store and they've done that seven-layer bean dip lasagna gardening idea. We give them the compost tea out of the store, the living solution, and they use it on their garden. And then the next year, the garden does great. So the moral of that story is compost everything before you put it in the garden. You know, and that's not to say you can't. You know, some people bury their banana peels and their newspaper clippings and different things like that. But unless you're really stimulating the life in the soil, that's not helping you on the level that it should. So it's really important to compost everything before you use it.
So the
okay,
compost tea is one method of introducing microbes into the soil. Are there others for people that don't have a compost tea machine?
Yeah, I mean, compost tea doesn't have to be complicated. You can compost in the corner of your yard. You don't need a bin. You don't need anything for that matter. You just need a space to dedicate to it. It's really composting is concentrating a natural principle for human benefit. So it's bringing organic matter and many times value-added organic matter into a scenario where you can inoculate it. So it would be really good to buy a really premium biological inoculant. There's a lot of products out there that are sold for this reason. It does Earth Recharge. I mentioned BD Thunder. Genesis Compounds, a product that we distribute. Both of those have all the microbes in it to begin with. There's many others out there. But start your compost pile with something. And then from then on, it's kind of like a mother with baking bread. You know, if you always leave an element of that biological decomposition where your compost pile is, there's always going to be microbes there to break it down. And so once you've started that compost, you can actually take, you know, once you've turned the newspaper and the banana peels and all that into what looks like, you know, soil, you can really do a visual test. It's that simple. You know, it should take, you know, 4 to 6 months if you're turning it. It can take, you know, 8 months to a year if you're not. And there's benefits to not turning it, but it kind of depends on what you want to get out of it. You can take a couple handfuls of that, put it in some pantyhose, stick it in a bucket, put a aerator on it, just like you would for an aquarium. You know, you aerate the water for fish to breathe. You're doing the same thing for the microbes. So when the microbes can breathe in the solution, then you introduce food sources like kelp or molasses or fish emulsion or what have you. And in the presence of food and oxygen, those microbes grow to really, really high concentrations. So it's, in a nutshell, compost tea is growing microbes. But you don't need to buy fancy units to do it. I mean, there's benefits to the Vortex Brewers that we distribute, but, you know, I'd be the last one to tell you it's the only way to do it. So, you know, it can be very accessible, a 5-gallon bucket and a $10 aquarium setup, you know, for the aeration, and you're rolling a bottle of molasses and some backyard compost.
That's fascinating. You had a question, Carol?
Yeah. This is kind of funny. I, you know, for my soil, you know, I'm just a beginner at this gardening stuff. I just went and bought Miracle-Gro Organic. So what is that product like?
Well, you set me up.
That's
a softball right there. See if I can knock it out. Because, you know, Miracle-Gro I'm not a fan of Miracle-Gro. You know, let's just put it that way. Unfortunately, you know, organic has become a way of the same companies to make more money, in my opinion. The true impulse of what the organic movement started, you know, say back in the 50s and the 60s, and what it culminated into in terms of the NOP and all of that, in terms of the certification from the USDA, is really kind of night and day. It's just different in terms of what the impulse was. So that being said, you can get, you know, if you can buy a frozen organic pizza in Walmart, that doesn't really kind of add up to what the true intentions of the organic movement was. And I'd say the same thing about bagged or Miracle-Gro Organic. You know, unfortunately, a lot of what that is chicken manures and then some cow manures. And, you know, these cows, if they go out on a pasture for an hour a week, it's organic, and they're all fed grains. And, you know, it's just, you know, it doesn't add up in the end. It's built for an economy, not for nourishment. So that being said, I've seen samples of Miracle-Gro Organic with fungus gnats all in it. It's just not on par with something that's been made with intention. Stop me there. Get us in trouble.
Well, here's the good news. I only bought one small bag of it and only used a little. So
Well, here's the thing. You know, try that versus something that you can make in your backyard or a value-added product, and really learn that for yourself. You know, I'm a big fan of not just asking people to trust me. You know, try it. You know, and we've actually got a promotion in our retail store that if you bring in products, Miracle-Gro products, we'll actually give you discounts towards ones that work better because we've just seen it so many times that it just doesn't have what plants need. I mean, just this isn't an organic example, but if you look at just an average Miracle-Gro product, you know, a plant has to have 17 elements to grow. It's called the essential nutrients. Now, plants want much more than that, and frankly, in my opinion, they need much more than that to grow in health, but we've established that there's 17 elements. If one of them isn't present, the plant can't form correctly. So a hydroponic nutrient, for example, would have 17 soluble elements in it. Miracle-Gro, as a liquid fertilizer, has 7. So what happens is it has 7 of the macronutrients that create a growth impulse. They make your plants obese. And to a human eye, you might think the plant's growing better. It's got more flowers. It's bigger. It's growing faster than you've ever seen. But what happens over time is it's just degeneration. I mean, what happens to us when we eat fast food every day? We make movies out of it, you know? I mean, we've already kind of made that connection in terms of human health. We just don't apply it to plant. But the parallels are life, man.
Awesome. Wow, that's really interesting how you put that. So I won't be buying that anymore.
Prove it yourself, though. You know, it's one thing to hear it; it's another to see it. You know, then you can have the wherewithal to tell other people. That's how it works.
Well, that's kind of funny because Matt and I were talking last night about how my plants are coming up so quickly. You think that's why?
Well, monitor it, you know. I mean, when you start getting pests and diseases, that's why, you know.
All right, well, it's time for another short break. You're listening to Food Integrity Now. We'll be right back after a quick message from our sponsors.
Masterson, Soul Purpose Astrologer, works with astrological tools and with guides in the non-physical to assist ones in knowing their soul purpose. Important in this process is identification of significant blockages. In each session, tools are provided for working with self to clear resistance and free talents, skills, and abilities to fuller expression. The goal is to take responsibility for and to accelerate the healing process. Phone sessions are offered by Linda. Please visit Linda at lindamasterson.com or call 808-651-0307. Again, that's 808-651-0307. Hello again, it's Carol. I'm one of the hosts of Food Integrity Now and a certified life coach, and I'd like to share with you an amazing adventure. I take groups on spiritual journeys to swim with the dolphins in the wild. If you'd like more information, please go to wilddolphinswimadventures.com or email me at carol@coachwithcarol.com. Mahalo.
Welcome back to Food Integrity Now with Evan Folds. We're talking about planting a backyard garden, and for the most part of the hour, we've been talking about soil health, which is a huge part of that. And I want to ask Evan about my own personal greenhouse. I've been, I'm about to use the mushroom compost, and living in the mountains here, we have an issue with bears, and I'm not really sure what I'm going to do about having a compost pile. I don't really want bears walking around my yard, picking through my compost pile. And but I think mushroom tea, is that something that I could get going in my house, Evan, and then add that to my mushroom compost?
Yeah, compost tea, absolutely it could. You know, that's, you know, the compost tea inoculant that we distribute is called Genesis Compound, and you need, you know, 2 ounces, which I think is 4 tablespoons. I could be wrong on that. I do conversions all day, and I tend to get confused, but the, you know, 2 ounces per about 15 gallons of solution. So, you know, you're looking at maybe a tablespoon or two for a 5 gallon bucket. So, you know, buying a cup of that and some earth tonic and getting you a bottle of molasses is absolutely a perfect way to deliver living microbes, because the benefit of compost tea is that you're growing the microbes. So you grow them to such a high concentration, you know, and you brew this solution for at least 12 hours, say 12 to 24 hours. And you could use 5 gallons to inoculate an entire acre of land. So, and that's, you know, that's about a 1 to 17 dilution. It takes about 85 gallons for us to spray an acre of land. It depends on your calibration. But so that ends up being about a cup per gallon dilution. So a little bit can go an extremely long way biologically. Obviously, if you dilute the compost you've created, you know, I think maybe we're going to try to touch on that in a future show, but compost tea is a living solution, and it's also a fertilizer because, you know, like we discussed, microbes make plant food, period. You know, that's how nature works. So when you're introducing molasses and kelp and fish emulsion and some value-added organic materials, you know, in the end, plants don't eat molasses and fish emulsion and kelp and bat guano in the end anyway. They eat what the microbes make of it. So when you've created this kind of alchemical summit where you have, you're encouraging the biological growth, but you're also getting the benefit of what the plant, of what the microbes have eaten to grow to that concentration. So it's kind of a double-edged sword in that regard, which means you can use it in limitless ways. So yeah, that would be a really good way of approaching it. You can also, you know, there's a books out there like Square Foot Gardening. You know, I mentioned the Lasagna Gardening book. You know, and it's not a bad place to go seeking those kinds of resources. But one unfortunate result of that is that people believe they can do it the wrong way. You know, when you have like a specific recipe, for example, Mel Bartholomew wrote Square Foot Gardening, and he's a proponent of it. It's a really good idea. He encourages people to find bulk organic matter where they are, because that's really what costs the most to ship in the end. You know, if you're shipping bags of soil across the country, it can get expensive really quick. So the fact that you got the mushroom compost is perfect. That's pretty much the equivalent of something like peat moss or core fiber, something that has really no nutritional value, but at the same time has the properties that create a really good soil. So what you could add to it is the compost tea, but for heavy feeders like a tomato, you're really going to need to introduce some kind of NPK-based value, some kind of fertilizer, so to speak. And there's a lot of really good granular fertilizers out there that are derived of, you know, feather meals and you know, rock phosphates and you know, different textured mineral inputs that's already been done for you. Or you could also seek out things like green sand. Green sand is a really good micronutrient, broad spectrum. Planters do, as a mite, you know, all these are mostly on the micronutrient end. So, you know, you kind of got the consistency of the soil, the organic matter, does it hold water, does it allow the aeration that you want? Then you got the micronutrient aspect, which is some of the things we just mentioned, and then you need to think about the macronutrient aspect when you got heavy feeders like a tomato. And those are kind of 3 general categories in terms of the makeup of the soil, that not including the microbes, which is something that you could add as well, that you'd really need to add as well. But in terms of the physical constituents of the soil, you're thinking about the organic matter, you know, can it hold moisture, and also allow aeration. So incidentally, when you see a potting soil and you see perlite in it, and little white specks you see in potting soil, the reason yeah. that's added is to allow aeration. So, you know, if you have too much water retention, you can really overwater a plant very easily. And you know, in my experience, that's really what a black thumb is. You know, people say they can't grow plants, and what it really is, and I think, unless you're just ignoring the plant and truly not engaged in what you're doing, is that people try to water their plants so much thinking that they need more water when they see them wilting and different things like that. But what it really does is suffocate the plant. It puts so much moisture into the soil that no oxygen can get down into the root zone. And, you know, we're used to thinking about plants producing oxygen, and on balance they do. They produce more than they consume, but their roots actually breathe oxygen in and use it for the sequestration of nutrients. So that's one of the ways you can, you know, cause some frustration for yourself is almost trying too hard. So it's very important to have some kind of aeration, and you really want 50% water retention, 50% aeration in a soil. That's one reason to use perlite in a potting soil.
So is perlite considered organic? What is perlite?
It's actually heated rock, so it pops out like popcorn, and it doesn't retain any moisture. So if you had a cup of perlite and you watered it, the water would run right through it. It doesn't retain it at all. So it's used literally for its aeration properties. So you may have read or heard of the idea of using vermiculite with perlite. And a lot of people start seeds that way. And the reason you do that is the perlite allows the drainage, the aeration, and then the vermiculite retains the moisture. So you kind of created a nice balance there for your plants to germinate. But again, perlite and vermiculite don't have any nutrition involved with them whatsoever. So, you know, when a seed is germinating, it actually has all the energy it needs for maybe the first 5 to 7 days in it. But after you get that, you know, the cotyledon, which is kind of the knee jerk, the first two set of leaves that comes out, then the second set of leaves is going to look differently than the cotyledon. Once you've reached that second set of leaves, the plant's really needing to eat outside of itself. So it's at that point you either need to transplant the plant or use some kind of fertilizer to fortify it with some nutrition.
All right.
Well, you know, this all sounds so complicated, and I hope this doesn't scare people from, you know, like you said, just getting out there and trying it, you know, making mistakes mm-hmm. and just, you know, mm-hmm. planning because, you know, soil testing and, you know, all the biology behind it, it's a little daunting, I think, for a lot of folks.
Yeah, you know, I wouldn't disagree. I mean, you know, in another way of looking at it, you can make anything complicated. And, you know, one of the things that really is confusing, and it was equally for me because, you know, like I've been trained in biology and I've come through school, you know, learning on the surface about agriculture and how they teach you in school about these things. And, you know, they've made it so much more complicated artificially than it is naturally. So really, you know, to speak to your point, Carol, because I think it's a valid one, you know, we can sit here and get into the minutia of all this all day and how you make your own mixes and But you hit the nail on the head. It's about doing it and learning from experience. And if you had to really isolate one takeaway from all of that, is really, you know, make sure that you're using materials that can be digested by microbes. In other words, use natural inputs. Because on balance, if you're stimulating your soil and feeding your soil instead of feeding your plant, that the microbes will make what's available to the plant available in a way that the plant needs it. You know, there's an intelligence in the soil that's completely obliterated with products like, you know, artificial Miracle-Gros and things like that. The mindset of Miracle-Gros is that you're feeding the plant, you're stimulating the plant, but what happens is that's at the expense of everything else. And then what you get to the diseases and the pests, and then you use the really harmful stuff, the herbicides and the pesticides and the fungicides that are truly bad for your health. You know, I'm not going to say Miracle-Gro is bad for your health, but it creates the situation where you're using things that are really bad for your health. So in the end, if you're encouraging life in the soil, not death, that's really kind of the one takeaway, because at some point you're going to turn the corner and start getting the success that you want. And I think everything else that we've been discussing here is really just a way of catalyzing that and making it happen sooner. But it doesn't have to be complicated. It's really a matter of feeding your soil instead of feeding your plant.
Well, I'm feeling really bad about my Miracle-Gro plants right now.
You know, it seems like any new topic, when you first get into it and you first get into a new hobby or a new endeavor, it feels like it seems so complicated. But then once you understand it, you wonder why it felt so complicated and hard to understand when you first got into it.
Yeah, you know, that's a really good point. You know, I think that can be illustrated by thinking about what pH is. You know, I think it's important to spend a minute on that because, you know, if anybody's ever gotten a soil test, they've looked at the pH in regards to is it healthy or not. And, you know, you want a pH in your soil, you know, anywhere from about 6 to 6.5 in the soil. And just, you know, this might sound technical, but I think it's important. I think it illustrates the point that you just made is that, you know, people can be overwhelmed by things that they don't understand. We all can, you know. pH is one of them. What pH is it's an algorithm or really a metric of how many hydrogen ions you have in soil. And the more hydrogen ions you have, the more acidic the soil is. So in general, soil should be, and, you know, that's true in blood and water and soil, wherever you're talking about pH. The more hydrogen ions, the more acidic. So what happens is the soil is negatively charged. in totality, and it opposites attract. So what happens over time is you have positive elements like calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium. Those are all positively charged elements. Those can all be held in the soil by the negative charge. Again, those opposites being attracted. So what happens is over time, the plant, it does a bait and switch. When it wants the calcium, it goes out and takes the calcium and then switches that with a hydrogen. So over time, what happens is your soil becomes more acidic. And that's happening because it's becoming demineralized. So given that explanation, make the connection of what lime is. So if anybody's ever had a pH issue or been advised in any way by a soil test or approached this gardening in any way, they've heard of sweetening the soil with lime. Well, very few people take the next step and actually look into what the lime is and how it operates. Lime is calcium and magnesium only. They're both positively charged elements. So what happens is when you use lime in a low pH soil that has a lot of hydrogen positive elements that are creating the acidity, you're replacing the hydrogen with the calcium and magnesium. Therefore, the pH goes up. There's less hydrogen. And it's really that simple. So, you know, make the connection. Say you have a really low pH. You got 5.5. And your extension service soil test is advising you on using so many pounds of lime per acre to correct it at 6.2. Well, that's all well and good. But what if you have a fourth of the potassium that you need in your soil? Lime doesn't address specific elemental deficiencies. It addresses the pH on a piece of paper. So the point being, in the end, is that what everybody's focused on in regards to soil health really means nothing in regards to the actual health of the soil. And round and round you go. So I hope that wasn't too complicated, but that's an example. If you really, you know, you took 5 minutes and really researched what pH is, and you make a connection of what we're focused on in regards to soil, you can see very quickly that we're not focused on what really brings us to the success. We're focused on what creates the correct data point on a piece of paper, which is, you know, in the end, it's really impossible to put your finger on one aspect of soil that creates health. It's about balance. And fortunately, nature seeks that balance innately. And unfortunately, what humans do is try to obliterate that at all costs, you know, unconsciously, really. But that's really the result of toxic rescue chemistry, of going out there and trying to kill weeds. It's not making the connection. The weed is growing for a reason. You know, there's a mechanism for that weed. So you can see how the perspective of what we're dealing with here and how you look at it is so important in how you go about working with it. It's really not about just following directions. It's more about being intuitive and opening your mind to what's happening within a living system and, frankly, being humble to the fact that you can't really ever figure it out. You know, I kind of equate it to playing golf. You know what I mean? Anybody out there that probably appreciate that. You can always shoot a better score, and you can even shoot the same score and play better. But it kind of never ends. You can never conquer the game. And it's the kind of same way about farming. If you go into it wanting to analytically figure it out and make it perfect, you're setting yourself up for failure.
Well, I feel like everything you just said right there is such a great metaphor for life. And it's also a metaphor for the way mass conscious society has come to live so many different aspects of our lives. And I feel like learn a lot from gardening and gardening from the perspective that you just illustrated.
Yeah, unfortunately, man, if that's not probably the most profound thing we've said, you know, I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. Unfortunately, we're coming to the end of our time with Evan today. Man, it just flew by. But we will have to get Evan back on really, really soon to continue the rest of our series. For the next, we haven't scheduled Evan on for his next appearance on our show yet, and for the next 3 weeks we are booked. But next week, be sure to tune in for Kristen Canty and Sally Fallon on their documentary Farmageddon. It's about to be released. We've had them on the show before, and the premiere is happening in LA next week, so that should be a great documentary to check out. And is there anything else you wanted to add, Carol?
No, I'm just real excited about doing all this growing of my own food myself. And as Evan said, we have to learn by our mistakes. And I guess I have a big one. So
we all do, Carol.
But I will carry on, and I learned a lot today, so I really appreciate all your information. And yeah, it's just wonderful to have such a great resource like you on our show. So thanks again.
Oh, well, thanks for having me. Be a farmer,
yeah,
start a garden.
Evan, as you all can see, Evan is just is amazing source of information for this, and we will be talking to Evan about when he can next appear on our show to spread some more of that knowledge.
Yeah, progressearth.com, right?
Yeah,
is your site?
That's correct.
Yeah.
That is correct. Thank you all for having
check
me.
Check it out. Okay, thank you. You got a lot of great products on there too to assist all of us in our growing needs. So thanks again.
Yeah, thank you, Evan. And we'll talk
very good
to you soon.
Thanks, Kath.
You're listening to Food Integrity Now. I'm Matt Spade. We will see you next week.